Bakasura represents cunning duplicity, deceptive behavior, and hypocrisy. The outward manifestations of a false lifestyle, of cheating activities. According to Brahmavaivata Purana, in his last life he was Suhotra, a Gandharva disciple of Devasa Muni. Along with his three brothers, or two brothers, there were three brothers, so along with the other two, who became Pralamba and Keshi, he performed austerities at Pushkar Tirtha. Once the three of them were picking lotuses at the celestial lake Chitrasarovara for offering to Lord Krishna, when they were arrested by servants of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva received them very nicely, but told them that he had promised Parvati that he would curse anyone who took lotuses from that lake, as she had vowed to offer 1,000 lotuses a day to Lord Krishna for 100 days. And there were exactly 100,000 lotuses there, some of which they had now picked. So they were cursed to appear as these demons, but then Lord Shiva told them that in the end they would be killed by Krishna and then liberated. Things were quite, rules and so on were appear to be rather stringent in those days. They were devotees, picking some flowers. Krishna asks for that in Bhagavad Gita. So they were doing that in Krishna consciousness. And then they get arrested and then cursed to become demons. So we're very fortunate that Lord Chaitanya has appeared. Otherwise, I don't think we would get so far. I don't know how many devotees there would be living in our temples or how many temples we would have. But I'm sure it would be a lot less. So now, let's see, this takes place. Krishna just turned 3, but he's under 5, so he's 3 or 4 at this point. And as we mentioned yesterday, the pastimes which we're going to be looking at now, they're more focusing on Sakyaras, or the friendly relationship with Lord Krishna. So these pastimes, they're all focusing on Krishna with the cowherd boys and herding the calves or the cows. In this case, the calves. And it's rather an extraordinary story, this. There are a few extra embellishments we'll introduce, which I think you'll find rather interesting. So, Krishna and Balaram were herding the calves, with the cowherd boys. And everyone became thirsty, the calves and the boys, they all became thirsty. So they made their way over to one big reservoir of water, a lake of some sort. And the animals drank, and after they had drunk, then the boys drank. This is a little in keeping of what we were describing yesterday. Dharmo rakshati rakshataha. That the boys didn't just run on ahead and think, well, these are just animals, so, you know, we should drink first. But they let the calves drink first, and then they drank. Then, right next to this lake or reservoir, they saw this monstrous animal, bird, baka. Prabhupada in the Krishna book describes or translates this word baka as duck, but more specifically, it refers to birds which are like storks or cranes. In fact, the term is used here and there in Srimad Bhagavatam, in a few places at least. And it's always translated as stork or crane, which of course is a type of duck, you could say, or at least they're very closely related, but slightly different, in that storks and cranes have very sharp beaks. Their beak comes to a point, whereas ducks have round beaks or whatever. So this was more like a stork and very big. He's not described so elaborately in Krishna book, but in Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada gives a little more elaborate description, which will sort of connect up with the little embellishments we're going to add at the end. He's described in the Bhagavatam as having a gigantic body resembling a mountain peak which has been struck down by a thunderbolt. Struck down, in other words, knocked off the top of the mountain and hurled down to the bottom. In other words, even though Bakasura, being very gigantic, looked very frightening, but he also looked a little the worse for wear, perhaps. Something like that, like he'd been smashed a bit. So we'll explain about that shortly. So he looked like that, like the peak of a mountain which has been smashed down by a thunderbolt. So this was Bakasura. And Bakasura is the brother of Agha and Putana. Agha is the youngest of the three, and out of Putana and Bakara, I don't know who's next, but Agha is the youngest. So he'd been sent, of course, by Kamsa, plus he had his own motive of revenge for Krishna killing his sister Putana. So he came to kill Krishna, first of all, by swallowing him. There's a very interesting description. He came and he grabbed Krishna in his two beaks and swallowed him, at least into his throat, began like the swallowing process. And Lord Balaram was there, but Lord Balaram didn't react. He didn't do anything. Not because he was thinking, as he thinks in other pastimes, that, well, Krishna is Krishna, so there's no need for me to get involved or like try and protect him. There's no need for anything like that. So therefore, I won't react. But it's described that under the influence of Yoga Maya, Lord Balaram, out of affection for Krishna, became bewildered. Therefore, he didn't react. So Krishna was being swallowed down this long neck of Bakasura. But then, in a second or a couple of seconds, just pass it forward. Keep this thing coming. Don't let it get hung up anywhere. And nobody steal it. So, Bakasura, after a few seconds, spat Krishna out. Two explanations are given for that in the Bhagavatam. One is that Krishna is the source of the Brahma Jyoti. So his body, it can be understood to be very, very hot, scorching, because the Brahma Jyoti is like that transcendental fiery effulgence that the sun is just a perverted reflection of. So, one explanation is that Bakasura felt Krishna within his throat to be extremely hot, intolerably hot. His throat was being burnt, so he just spat him out. Another explanation, which is a very nice explanation, is that Krishna's body is sweet, very sweet. In fact, his body, like Srila Rupa Goswami says, that the holy name of Krishna is sweet like sugar candy. Sugar candy is sugar in its most condensed form and its sweetest form. So Krishna, the holy name of Krishna, is sweet like sugar candy. And what is the holy name? The holy name is Krishna. Therefore the holy name is sweet. Who has not marked themselves present? Who should have? Krishna's name is sweet, which means that Krishna's sweet. Rupa Goswami, as a realized devotee, is tasting Krishna's presence on his tongue and finds it to be most most relishable, literally. There's also the story, I'm sure many of you have heard, Krishna floating on the banyan leaf. You know that story, little baby Krishna? That banyan leaf, incidentally, is a form of Lord Balaram. Lord Balaram assumes different forms to assist Krishna in his pastimes. One of them is that banyan leaf. So little baby Krishna is there, lying on the banyan leaf, sucking his big toe, one of his big toes. And one devotee asked Krishna, "Why are you sucking your toe?" And Krishna said, "Well, I hear my devotees, so many of them say that my lotus feet are sweet. So I wanted to try them out to see whether it's true. And I see that it is true. They are sweet." And then Krishna continued to suck on his toe. So Krishna's body is sweet, but Rupa Goswami, in that particular verse, it's in Nectar of Instruction actually, where he says Krishna's name is sweet like sugar candy. He says that even though that's a fact, still, for a person who has the material disease, which is something like jaundice, for someone who's in Maya, then they don't taste the sweetness. But they taste Krishna's name to be bitter, and so therefore they won't want to chant it. So similarly, Bakasura is a demon. So even though Krishna's body is sweet, as he was sucking on or swallowing Krishna's body, and he was tasting Krishna's body, he tasted it to be most unpleasant. Therefore he spat Krishna's body out. Well, he spat Krishna out. So, he's really a demon. Yayatamam prapajante. As, depending on how one approaches Krishna, Krishna reciprocates. So it's like that. When one becomes advanced, then one will want to be in contact with Krishna all the time, particularly in the form of his holy name. As we mentioned a few days ago, that contact with Krishna in his name, in the form of his name, that is like the foundation for any other realizations we may have or that may gradually come to us as we make progress in Krishna consciousness. So, as one advances in chanting, one comes to like it more and more. In the earlier days, one will think that, you know, it's the evening, one still has 4 or 6 rounds to chant, and one is struggling, thinking, oh, when am I going to finish? And when you finish, you think, oh, I finished now. Do something. Oh, well. Hare Krishna. So we may think like that, but there's one interesting conversation, I should have actually brought it. Prabhupada talking with one of his disciples about spontaneous attraction. And Prabhupada says, this is the difference between you and me, that I like it, therefore I do it. But you do it because you have to. This is the difference between you and me. Therefore I get up at midnight and I work so hard, because I like it, not because I have to. But you get up in the morning and you chant because you have to. So that's the difference. So Prabhupada, of course, was on the most exalted level of spontaneous devotional service, to say the least. So he would chant Hare Krishna and 16 rounds. He would just go on chanting and chanting and chanting, relishing it all the time. Whereas we, gradually as a devotee gets into it, the devotee finds it more and more enjoyable. Actually, the fact that Krishna's body is so sweet is sometimes a problem in Krishna's pastimes. When Jatila or Kutila are trying to catch Radha and Krishna together, but normally Krishna makes a getaway, then Jatila or Kutila or whoever bursts in on the scene, but Krishna's not there. But then they can smell the fragrance of Krishna's body. And so they know Krishna was here. So it can be a problem. So Krishna's body is very sweet, sweeter than sweet, and so fragrant. But when you're a demon, then, like Bakasura, you find it to be most unpleasant. So therefore Bakasura just spat him out, and then his next idea was, let me just cut him in two with my beaks. First of all, he was going to swallow him and kill him that way. Now use the beaks as a weapon to cut Krishna and kill him in that way. But we all know that Krishna grabbed hold of the two beaks and then just split Baka's mouth and head open, bifurcated him. Prabhupada says, just like a child splits a blade of grass, just like that. Bakasura's head just was split apart, and that was the end of Bakasura, at least for that lifetime. Now, just a little bit of extra information. This is from Garga Samhita. As we mentioned, when Bakasura came on the scene, the description is that he looked like a mountain peak which had been struck down by a thunderbolt. Smashed, in other words. Smashed by a thunderbolt. In other words, he wasn't in such good shape. So the description is that as Bakasura was coming to kill Krishna, to attack Krishna, then the demigods were aware of that. So the demigods, being devotees, they decided that let's intervene and let's try to protect Krishna. So the demigods came and attacked Bakasura. So listen to this description, it's quite interesting. Indra was the first. He came and hurled his thunderbolt and knocked Bakasura to the ground. But Bakasura got up again and continued. Then Lord Brahma came with his Brahma Danda. These are like the characteristic weapons of these demigods. So Brahma came with his Brahma Danda, with his stick, and smashed Bakasura on the head and knocked him unconscious for 48 hours. So he really smashed him hard. But then he got up again. Then Lord Shiva came and hurled his trident at him and cut off one of his wings. But the demon recovered. Then Vayu came and struck him with his wind weapon. But Baka, with one wing, because he's now lost one wing, Baka flew away somehow. Then Yamaraj came with his Yamadanda, like the stick of justice, and smashed Bakasura with his Yamadanda, but the danda broke. He had a hard head. Then Surya came and attacked him with 100 arrows, but he still didn't die. Then Kuvera came and hacked at him with his sword and cut off the other wing. So Bakasura now is wingless, but still he didn't die. Then Soma attacked him with his ice weapon. Tormented by the cold, Bakasura fainted, but then he got up again. Then Agni attacked him with his fire weapon and burned all his feathers to ashes. Poor Bakasura. Anyway, we shouldn't think like that, of course. But still he didn't die. Then Varuna came, tied him up with his ropes, and dragged him along the ground. But still Bakasura didn't die. Then Bhadrakali came. Kali Ma came and beat him on the head with her club and broke his head and he fainted and went into a deep coma. But then he got up again, shook himself, and roared like a cloud, like thunder. Then Kartikeya came and threw his Shakti weapon and cut off one of Bakasura's legs. But then Bakasura turned on the demigods and attacked them, and they were all forced to just run away in fear of their lives. Then Bakasura proceeded to try to attack Krishna. So therefore, when Bakasura came on the scene, he looked like a mountain peak which had been struck down by a thunderbolt. You know, really quite something, but still he had been smashed. No wings, no feathers, and one leg. But still, he was enthusiastic. So now, Bakasura, to be quite honest, I can't really figure out how to connect up Bakasura, his nature, his appearance, his activities, and the Anatha. Should we just do without this, perhaps? Oh, the behavior, hypocrisy, a false lifestyle. Now, of course, that is very serious type of anatha. Hare Krishna. So, anyway, let's give it a try. It's a very serious anatha, and it's one that we should try and understand and try to avoid ourselves. But how Bakasura exactly represents it, I don't know if any of you have any ideas. Personally, I don't, but it's coming from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, so I just accept it. This is the way it is. Prabhupada gives an interesting, gives a few like definitions of duplicity. One which I found, which I thought was very nice and very applicable actually, at least something which we can relatively easily apply on ourselves and see how we're living up to it or not. Prabhupada says that duplicity means to imitate a position which you don't have. And he gives the example of a kshatriya trying to act as a Brahmin. Or, you know, a brahmachari trying to act as a householder, or a householder trying to act as a brahmachari, or this type of idea. Actually, we're going to also discuss this a little bit in one of the other anathas. But it's an interesting type of concept, that you're trying to act in a way according to a position, because we don't act arbitrarily. We act in terms of varnashram, actually. We shouldn't think that, yes, I'm transcendental, so therefore, whatever ashram I'm in, it doesn't really matter, but I'm just going to act in some other way because I'm transcendental. We act according to varnashram. So every one of us has a position in varnashram, brahmachari or brahmacharini, grihastha, vanaprastha or sannyasi. These are the four positions in varnashram. And then we also have our occupational duties. There's a little more flexibility according to how Prabhupada applied varnashram. But Prabhupada is saying here that duplicity means to imitate a position which you don't really fit into, but perhaps out of some sense of false prestige you want to act like that. Sometimes we find brahmacharis or brahmacharinis who really should be married, but they're trying to artificially maintain the position of being unmarried, and it doesn't work. And in the end they get disturbed, or they are disturbed already. They become more disturbed and they disturb others. Or there are even some cases of people who are householders, but then they try and manifest a more renounced lifestyle than they're really capable of doing, and as a result their lives become disturbed. So that's one idea of duplicity, and we should try to understand what is my nature, what is my position. We don't need to get into the Viuddhavikalpa type of situation. If you remember Viuddhavikalpa, extensive speculation. If we're not clear, and it's not so uncommon that devotees become unclear about where they should really fit in. It happens fairly frequently. So if we're unclear, then we shouldn't just get into our heads and sort of go around in circles inside our minds, but we should refer to the spiritual master, and hopefully one has a relationship with the spiritual master in which one can have that sort of access to him and discuss things in some detail about one's life. If one has that sort of relationship, it's very good. Otherwise, one can discuss with senior Vaishnavas who know one, and in this way get some direction. But one shouldn't imitate some position that one doesn't fit into. One will just cause harm to oneself. Now, duplicity, another, like a little different viewpoint on duplicity, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he wrote one song or book, I think it's a book actually, Vaishnav K. I was actually trying to find a copy of it last night, but I couldn't. Anyway, very appropriate. Mind, what sort of Vaishnav are you? How does it go? Dushtamana, tumi kishera Vaishnav. My mind, what sort of Vaishnav are you? Pratishtara tare, nirjanera gare, tavahari nam kevala kaitav. Mind, what sort of Vaishnav are you? Trying to chant Hare Krishna in a solitary place like your Haridas Thakur, but tumi hari nam kevala kaitav, your hari nam is simply cheating, that's all. Prabhupada, I found one very interesting quote, because there's so many of these people around Vrindavan. So many of these people, they come to Vrindavan with the idea of sitting down and chanting, but in so many cases they can't maintain that standard, and some of them break regulative principles. Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, they spoke very strongly against this. Here's a nice little quote from Prabhupada about exactly this sort of person. They come to Vrindavan and think, oh, I've now become a great scholar, and I've now learned how to become a great Vaishnav. I chant 64 rounds and think of my wife sometime, and then goodbye to Govindaji and leave Vrindavan. I'll just read this whole thing. It's from one of Prabhupada's lectures, 1976, in Vrindavan. Manatumi kishera Vaishnav. Mind, what sort of Vaishnav are you? Why? To get some cheap adoration as a great chanter. Because if one is actually chanting, why should be attracted by woman and bidi? If he's actually in such position like Haridas Thakur, then why should he be attracted? It's a false show only. That's not possible for an ordinary person. Therefore, ordinary person must be physically engaged. That is not physical, that's also transcendental. Always busy in some business of Krishna consciousness. That is wanted. Not that, what I just said. I've become a great scholar. I've now learnt how to become great Vaishnav. I'll chant 64 rounds and then think of my wife sometime. And then goodbye to Govindaji and leave Vrindavan. Because Govindaji is presiding deity here. These rascaldom do not follow. Govindaji drives such rascals away from Vrindavan. So, Vrindavan, one who's living in Vrindavan, he must be very anxious how to spread the glories of Vrindavan Chandra all over the world. That is wanted. Not that Vrindavan Chandra is my private property and I sit down in a place and lick him up. And when one is actually an experienced preacher, then he's able to chant Hare Krishna mantra without any offense. Before that, the so-called chanting of Hare Krishna mantra, you may practice without any offense, giving up all other business to make a show of a big Vaishnava, but that is not required. Even sometimes we have experience. Even within ISKCON it happens, a little bit sometimes. Someone is spaced out devotee somewhere, then they come to Vrindavan, you see them a few months later, and now they're manjaris, or something like that. Or maybe not quite that drastic. But we do find sometimes that people join ISKCON and you see here's one bhakta, he's sort of like a regular bhakta, nothing really very special, just beginning. But then he becomes attracted by the Babaji's. And then you find out in a little while, now he's initiated and he's now such and such manjari and his sadhana is some sort of extremely esoteric practice. But you remember, he was just spaced out bhakta, such and such. So he still is. But now he's in this sort of dream world that I've become very exalted. So Prabhupada's stressing here and referring to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, that before you can really come and sit down in Vrindavan and chant, you have to preach, you have to work hard. And then when you're purified to some extent, then you may be able to chant without offenses. Otherwise, Prabhupada says, vigorously, very vigorously, one must very vigorously preach. So we shouldn't be duplicitous in that way. It's nice to come and visit Vrindavan, but we shouldn't come and think, oh, let me stay and then I'll just get into higher levels of Krishna consciousness just by being here. But one has to cultivate Krishna consciousness and practice very seriously in order to become purified so that higher levels become more accessible. In Nectar of Devotion, there's description of Bhakti Abbas. Actually, Bhava Abbas, specifically. Bhava Abbas. And elsewhere we find descriptions of Bhakta Abbas. Abbas means a shadow or a reflection. And in Nectar of Devotion, it's described that you may find two types of people who are in this Abbas state of Bhava Abbas, meaning they seem to be very ecstatic. But you know, they can't really be that advanced. So one is an impersonalist. An impersonalist who, in the course of his practice of impersonalism, is taught that if you worship Krishna, it'll help. In fact, this is very popular, even here in Vrindavan. There are many people walking around with tilak and japa beads, but they're actually impersonalists. Not just like if you analyze on a deeper level, but they're specifically impersonalists. And because Shankaracharya, he taught that if you want to merge in Brahman, then you have to go through this level of worshipping the different deities, and Krishna or Vishnu is one of them that you have to worship. So there are many people here in Vrindavan who are actually impersonalists, meaning they're in that sampradaya, some division of that sampradaya, and their whole idea is to merge in Brahman, but they're here because it's part of the process according to their understanding. Even there are now four Shankaracharyas in India. When Shankaracharya was here, he established four main temples and his four main disciples became the Acharyas and they became known as Shankaracharyas. So that line is still going on. So one of the Shankaracharyas came here couple of years ago, or maybe, yeah, say a couple of years ago. And he was invited, believe it or not, to give a program at Nityanandavat. I don't know if you know where Nityanandavat is. Shringarvat, the place where Lord Nityananda used to sit. So the people who run that place, they invited this one of these four Shankaracharyas, and he gave a lecture, and so many people came, and they were listening and thinking, oh, very nice. And he was talking from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Ujjvala Neelamani, but it was all impersonal. Underneath, it was all impersonal. But so many people were attracted that this is big sadhu Shankaracharya. So here in Vrindavan, there are many people who are impersonalists, and then there are many other people who are just confused. They think they're Sakis or Manjaris or whatever, like the Babajis. So we have in Vrindavan a whole collection of people. There are also some nice devotees, but for one who doesn't know, one can get very easily misled and think this place is just full of nice devotees. But it's not quite like that. So duplicity is quite a big thing. So anyway, there's one category of bhava abhas, like a manifestation of some ecstasy even, externally, but actually it's just a shadow or a reflection. So one type is amongst impersonalists. They chant Hare Krishna, and sometimes they become very blissful. Then another type is people who are materially attached, but somehow, because they get some good association, something is just struck within their heart, so they become very blissful. Sometimes people, like big businessmen even here in India, they would associate with Srila Prabhupada, and something within their hearts would be touched off. And then for a few days, they'd be with Srila Prabhupada the whole time, just like absorbed. Then a few days later, they'd disappear, and they wouldn't be seen again. So this is the type of thing. Bhava abhas or bhakti abhas, a reflection. So we should be careful, we have to be very careful. Like when four devotees, going back to the early 70s or so, four devotees started coming up with some impersonal philosophy within ISKCON, the bottom line of which was that they were taking Prabhupada to be Krishna. So Prabhupada expelled them immediately from the movement, very strongly, just kicked them right out. So we have to be careful of duplicity, particularly within ourselves. In fact, when Lord Brahma created the universe, there are five fundamental features of material existence which he created, like psychological features. Bodily concept, fear of death, and various others. But one of them is self-deception, that we deceive ourselves, fool ourselves. And the association of devotees is very important for that. Devotees are very merciful, that if they see you're deceiving yourself, then generally they'll tell you, and then I mean, sometimes they may tell you a little over-vigorously. But at least they tell you. They don't patronize you and tell you, oh yes, you're a great devotee. You must almost be on the platform of the Manjaris. No, they'll tell you, you're a nonsense. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that when you chant Hare Krishna, if you're not careful, you're chanting along with weeding your devotion, nourishing your devotional kripa, it can also nourish weeds, like all sorts of misconceptions, particularly about oneself. So, how do you protect yourself? Lord Chaitanya says, surround yourself with a fence made up of the association of pure devotees. Then you'll be protected from all these things. So, duplicity, this tendency to be like two-faced, double-sided, it's a very dangerous thing. And we mentioned that Prabhupada has said that we shouldn't imitate, and it's even worse if just by mistake, without even understanding, we put ourselves into a position which we're not really on. One other idea which is given by Srila Prabhupada, how to combat duplicity within ourselves, is to cultivate simplicity. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that one of the qualities of a Brahman is arjavam, and arjavam means simplicity. And in fact, in the seventh canto, when Narada Muni is discussing the qualities of a human being, he says that this arjavam, simplicity, is one of the essential qualities of a human being. In fact, he says that if there's duplicity, human society cannot be peaceful if duplicity is there. Simplicity has to be there. Let's see. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. Prabhupada quotes Bhaktisiddhanta. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur comments that saralata, or simplicity, is the first qualification of a Vaishnava, whereas duplicity or cunning behavior is a great offense. Prabhupada gives a very interesting example of simplicity. It's very, very nice. He says, this is child's nature. So Prahlad Maharaj was in that position. He didn't care. His father wanted to chastise him in so many ways. Prahlad didn't care. He was always thinking, he's my father. He's joking, that's all. Amazing. He was thinking, he's my father. He's just joking. So this is simplicity. There's another description I came across that when Prahlad, Hiranyakashipu would ask Prahlad, where's this God of yours? Where's this Vishnu? And Prahlad would say, he's everywhere. And Prahlad was not like a big philosopher thinking in philosophical terms so much. He was a little boy, 5 years old. So the explanation is that Prahlad was actually seeing him everywhere. So when he would answer that, oh, he's everywhere, he was just being straightforward. He wasn't being deeply philosophical. And it got to the point, because Hiranyakashipu asked him on a number of occasions, it got to the point that Prahlad was thinking, why does my father keep asking me this silly question? Can't he see that he's everywhere? Because he was seeing him everywhere. So this is simplicity. So we should try to be simple. Prabhupada would say that Krishna consciousness is simple for the simple and complex for the complicated or the duplicitous. Of course, simple doesn't mean like a simpleton, but it means in that mood of not like artificially making things complicated through materialistic intellectualism, speculation, and selfish concerns, mundane concerns like that. Just surrender, here I am, Krishna. Like that, in that type of mood. In Bhagavad Gita also, when Krishna, in the 17th chapter, Krishna talks about austerities. One of the austerities, austerity of the body, includes simplicity. This is also given by Krishna as like fundamental teaching in Bhagavad Gita. Try to maintain a mood of simplicity or straightforwardness, honesty. Then it also comes up in the field of something like book distribution. We know, perhaps not so much now, but going back to the time that Prabhupada was on the planet, there were many big debates. What can you say? Prabhupada once said that by hook or by crook, get them to take a book. Prabhupada also said that you should preach to them and explain about Krishna, and in that way get them to take a book. But those who by nature are a little more inclined by conditioning to the crooked side, then when they heard this by hook or by crook, they thought, oh yes, very good. So it became very controversial. So Prabhupada, one time, he gave like some judgments on the subject. He said that yes, in one sense you can say anything, and if they take a book or accept Krishna consciousness, then that sort of justifies it. The end justifies the means. But then Prabhupada said that acting like this, this is more for big experts in Krishna consciousness. Though, he said, those who know how to catch the big fish without themselves getting wet. And then Prabhupada went on to say that actually better if you just describe Krishna to them. Because Krishna is all attractive, so that means there's something about Krishna which can attract every living entity. So you just have to figure out what it is which will attract the particular living entity that you're speaking to, and then he'll become attracted to Krishna. And Prabhupada said, you can glorify Krishna in any way, and it won't be exaggeration, because Krishna is so great. So better to be like that. And Prabhupada would say that he wanted that this movement, the devotees in this movement, would become known as first-class gentlemen. People of first-class character. So even though it can be argued, and there is a place in one sense for like misleading people a little bit perhaps so that they take Krishna consciousness, on the absolute platform, you can't absolutely argue against it. In fact, Prabhupada gives the example of Maharaj Yudhisthira, who refused to tell a lie. Therefore, he had to see hell. He refused Krishna's request to tell a lie. But we should be very, very careful and generally maintain a standard of simplicity and straightforwardness. Prabhupada said that this means that a Brahmin, if his enemy comes and asks some information, which may even be against that Brahmin, still the Brahmin will give the answer, correct answer, that it's like this. Any comments or questions? Well, we have to accept Krishna consciousness without making it more complicated than it is by thinking, getting into all sorts of personal mental considerations and considerations about our sense gratification and things like this. If we accept Krishna consciousness in an honest and straightforward way and really try to just surrender, this is the foundation for the simplicity. And then along with it, by Krishna's grace, one will get knowledge how to act nicely and deal with situations. Like Srila Prabhupada, we mentioned, I think, yesterday or the day before. Sometimes he appeared to be so innocent that sometimes devotees would wonder, how could he be? How could he have done what he's done if he's like this? But at the same time, he was so deep. So that the basis of that simplicity was that wholehearted surrender without holding back and thinking, you know, what are my interests and how am I going to utilize Krishna consciousness for me? So if we act like that, in that mood, then by Krishna's grace, you know, we'll have that innocence and simplicity to not get hung up by this duplicity. But also we'll have the intelligence how to act nicely and intelligently also by the grace of Krishna. Some other comments or questions?
Is it not that people take advantage of simple things?
Yes, if they're materially simple. Yes. But a devotee, you know, a devotee is very intelligent because the devotee is in touch with Krishna. Krishna, after all, is supplying knowledge, intelligence, remembrance, forgetfulness, and everything like that. And this mood of simple surrender to Krishna doesn't mean abandoning one's intelligence. It means that one is not using one's intelligence in that, like, a cheating way of how can I exploit Krishna consciousness like that, which, you know, sometimes happens. Some devotees think like that. How can I get some service which I will benefit from in some material way myself? Bhattaji? Well, there's a demon. There's Madhu and Kaitabha. There were two demons who appeared right at the beginning of creation. Madhu and Kaitabha. They were killed by Lord Vishnu. You know, the exact details I don't know, but all the details, at least, I don't know, but Madhu and Kaitabha, they're well-known demons right from the very, very early days of the universe. Therefore, Krishna's called Madhusudana, the killer of the demon Madhu. Yeah. But Kaitabha also, I don't know if it's related to the name Kaitabha. Kaitabha means cheating. Dharma Projita Kaitavotra. That the Bhagavatam begins by completely rejecting cheating religion or materialistic religion. We're going to talk about that more. One of the other demons represents cheating religion. We'll talk about it more then.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the five inbuilt psychological features.
Oh, Krishna, what are they? Bodily identification, fear of death, self-deception, anger after frustration, and one other. I don't know.
Like false proprietorship.
Is it?
False, we think that we are the proprietor of.
That's actually one of the five, is it? Okay, false proprietorship. If you want to check any of them, they're in the Bhagavatam.
Is it five what?
They're like the five fundamental characteristics of mundane consciousness created by Brahma at the beginning of creation. It's in the Bhagavatam when Brahma is going through the creation of different stages, then he manifests these things. You know that picture of Brahma we have sitting down with all the different parts of the creation coming from his body? Then I think above his head you have these five persons representing these five features of mundane consciousness.
So self-deceit means delusion also, eh?
Self-deception, yes. You deceive yourself. You're a spirit soul, but you think, no, 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 I'm not a spirit soul. I'm this body. Self-deception. So in the name of being in our bodies, we deceive ourselves in so many ways. Like on the mundane level, people smoke cigarettes and they know that it's killing me, wasting my money, but still they think, well, it's okay, I'll just carry on because I like it. So they're deceiving themselves. This is one of the basic features of mundane consciousness.
I wanted to ask about the perfect dealing because I've been in Sankirtan with the people who say they are foreign Christian religion. Once I heard the Prabhupada said actually they are wasting their time. And other persons say that we should not interfere too much, so otherwise they will lose their faith in them. So what is the best?
Best thing to do, speaking in very simple terms, because it's quite a deep subject, but best thing is if you find that any person, be they Christian or whatever, they don't want to accept Krishna consciousness, then try and give them some prasad, if you can. Or try and allow them to hear the holy name, ask them for a donation, just engage them in some way. Yeah. But we don't want to get into these big verbal standoffs, these big arguments. It's just a waste of time. That's becomes the ninth offense against the chanting of the holy names. They become even more envious. So if you see this person is just not going to accept, then if you can engage them in some way which they'll be prepared to do, and then just leave it at that.
That you should stop eating meat and chant the name of Krishna. Is this they make advancement? I mean, this is perfect.
Oh, they'll make advancement. They'll certainly make advancement if they do that. If they'll do that. I don't know how many of them would do it, but if they would do it, they'd definitely make advancement. And when Prabhupada was preaching to Christians, I think that was almost the only thing he'd ever discuss with them. Why aren't you following this instruction? Otherwise, I've seen a few conversations. Someone come, you know, they show that, you know, I have my philosophy and I'm attached to it. And Prabhupada would say, well then, how can we discuss? How can we discuss? If you already have your philosophy and you're not interested to learn, so how can we discuss? So Prabhupada oftentimes wouldn't bother. He'd just tell them just to go away. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.